You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, wherever you are, whoever you are. No matter where you may be on this planet, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very, very first time tonight, and if you are, I want to welcome you and invite you to make a habit out of this. You want to be back each and every night, Monday through Friday. Because we always have something good happening here on The Kevin Smith Show. Interesting guests, interesting topics, great discussion. Tonight my guest will be Professor Robert Temple and his wife Olivia Temple. Robert Temple is the author of a bunch of books. He's got about a dozen very challenging, provocative books out there. Including the bestseller, The Serious Mystery, and that's S-I-R-I-U-S, The Serious Mystery. His books have been translated into a total of 44 foreign languages. He is a visiting professor of history and philosophy of science, and I probably will say this wrong, but I think it's Tsinghua University in Beijing. Previously held a similar position at the American University, and for many years he was a science writer for the Sunday Times, The Guardian, and a science reporter for Time Life, as well as a frequent reviewer for Nature and a profile writer for The New Scientist. He is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and has been a member of the Egypt Exploration Society since the 1970s. He has produced, written, and presented a documentary for Channel 4 and for National Geographic channels on his archaeological discoveries in Greece and Italy, and he was at one time an arts reviewer on BBC Radio 4's Kaleidoscope. In 1993, his translation of the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh was performed at the Royal National Theatre in London. With his wife Olivia, he is the co-author and translator of the first complete English version of Aesop's Fables, and that received a great deal of international press attention at the time of its release. The earlier translations had suppressed some of the parts of the fables because of Victorian prudery. He is a colleague of the late Dr. Joseph Needham of Cambridge, in association with whom he wrote The Genius of China, which has been approved as an official reference book in Chinese for the Chinese secondary school system, and it has won 5 national awards in the USA. His research into historical accounts of the Sphinx is the first comprehensive survey undertaken, and we'll be talking about that tonight. His wife, Olivia, is also very, very accomplished. She is a published author, published writer with articles appearing in many well-known publications. She's also an artist whose paintings have been exhibited at such galleries as the Delahaye Gallery, Neville Gallery, Addison Ross Gallery, and others. She's quite a gardener as well. You can read some of her articles and view pictures of some of her paintings as well as some of her garden projects at her website. We're going to be talking with Robert and Olivia Temple about the Sphinx mystery when we come back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guests this evening are Robert and Olivia Temple, joining us from the UK. And they are so accomplished in their lives that to introduce them, I normally have a news story or two at the beginning of the show, but I took that to introduce them, and there is yet more, believe me. Robert and Olivia, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hello, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of fun talking to you because you're a nice Texas boy.
Hi there.
Hello. I've told this. My listeners have all heard this story, but you haven't, and I'll tell it quickly. I speak several languages, and one of them is Serbian. And several years ago, I was in the Ruski Tsar bar in Belgrade, and I was talking to the bartender in Serbian, and a guy walks in and looks at me sort of intently, and I'm thinking, oh no, this is going to be a problem. But he walks over and he did his hand like a gun, where you stick your finger out and your thumb up, you know, and he did his hand like a gun, and he said, "Texas, no?" And I said, "Da." And I asked him, how did he know? Well, he recognized the Texas in my Serbian. And he used to...
I thought you were going to say he recognized the Serbian in your Texas.
No, he...
That is amazing.
Yeah, he used to work in Houston, Texas, with one of the refineries there. And so he was accustomed to hearing a Texas accent. And he recognized that even though I was speaking Serbian. So I guess maybe I should just sort of add some Southern to my Serbian to make it absolutely certain for everyone, you know, like Dobar dan, y'all.
Well,
all right.
Everybody knows that Southerners are nicer than other people. I'm a Kentuckian myself.
Are you really?
I am.
Where in Kentucky?
Well, I come from an obscure corner of the bluegrass, squeezed in between a couple of horses.
Robert actually knew Colonel Sanders when he was a boy, when he only had one little place where he sold his fried chicken, and Robert went there as a child with his mother, and he used to ask Colonel Sanders what the recipe was for his fried chicken, but Colonel Sanders was a difficult old and wouldn't tell him.
Yeah.
He told me bits and pieces. I used to tell him I was just a little boy, and he could safely tell me because I wasn't going to tell anyone. He didn't fall for that.
No. Well, he was a pretty sharp guy. You know, the first time I ever had any of the Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken was in Canada. And I never ran into it in the United States before that. So that was a number of years ago. Many years ago, I was 11 years old, and that's the first time I ever tasted it. Thought it was the greatest stuff on earth. Well, tell me about the way
he used to cook it himself was pretty delicious.
Yeah,
far superior to the franchise because he took a lot of care over it and was very proud of it.
Well, let's get into this book of yours, The Sphinx Mystery. There are many, many books out there and DVDs all having to do with this mysterious thing called the Sphinx, and they all come from different perspectives. A lot of them are sort of New Age, and a lot of them propose some pretty strange theories, although strange, they may be true, I don't know. But you've written a book called The Sphinx Mystery that is from a pretty unique perspective. What is this book about?
Well, primarily the book starts by demonstrating that just about everything everybody thought they knew about the Sphinx is wrong, and we go on from there.
What are some of the things that are generally accepted that are wrong?
Well, it's generally accepted that the Sphinx has the body of a lion and the head of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so we devote a great deal of time and evidence to showing that, first of all, it did not originally have the head of a man. If you look carefully at it, the head is very tiny compared to the huge body, and they're out of proportion. So the idea is that the head was recarved at some later date and cut down. So then what was it? Then you have to look at the body and you realize that's no lion's body, because anyone who's ever seen a lion knows they don't look like that. Mm-hmm. The Sphinx has a completely straight back. It doesn't rise up in the front. There's no great big chest. There's no mane. There's nothing remotely leonine or lion-like about the body of the Sphinx. So what I suggest is that, in fact, originally what it was a giant dog known as Anubis crouching there as the guardian of the necropolis.
What made you come to the conclusion, what led you to the conclusion that it was Anubis?
Well, the first thing that led us to think that, both of us, as we stood there looking at the Sphinx for the very first time, was that it was not a lion. And also, the head was not original. That just seemed to us obvious in the very first split second. So then, if it wasn't a lion and it wasn't with the head of a man, what was it? And it looked to us like a dog, because we're dog lovers, and dogs fit like that. And the Anubis, which I well knew, is the guardian of the dead, and there he was guarding the great cemetery of Giza.
One of the things that we did, Kevin, was to look into the travelers' tales, people who had traveled to Egypt over a long period of time, basically from Pliny, who talked about the Sphinx. He spoke about that in the first century AD, but we've studied 281 years of published eyewitness accounts, and I've translated quite a few of those from French, Robert from the German. Some of them are in English, but for instance, in 1733, one guy called Charles Thompson, who traveled through Turkey in Asia to the Holy Land, Egypt, and other parts of the world, he says that he visited the Sphinx about a quarter of a mile to the east of the Second Pyramid. It is usually called a Sphinx, which is a fabulous monster, having the head and breasts of a woman, the wings of a bird, the claws of a lion, and the body like a dog.
Charles Thompson was notorious for getting a bit carried away.
Well, I think that's great. He saw that there was a dog.
So,
well, there you go. Anybody who sees a dog can't be all wrong. And you've got a dog in Thailand. I know that because we talked earlier.
That's right. That's right. And his name is Jonup. And it's just possible Jonup is listening tonight. So,
Jonah?
I'm sorry?
Woof, woof.
Yeah, he's a little bitty dog, little guy, heart of a lion.
Well, then I should say, woof, woof.
All right, now so then early travelers were not saying that that this was a lion. They were describing it as the body of a dog. Now, in that description that you read, I missed, what does it say about the head?
The head and breasts of a woman. So, don't forget that the body was largely covered up with sand when a lot of these people went out there over the hundreds and thousands of years, the Sphinx has been mostly covered in sand. The head would stick up like a mushroom out of the sand occasionally, and then when it was cleared of sand, the spine of the dog appeared, and the rest of the body, and finally the long tail and the long feet. But the face was, when it was recarved as this pharaoh that we believe it to have been in the likeness of, it still has this rather enigmatic, slightly female smile, a bit like the Mona Lisa.
We don't know if the guy was gay.
Well, you never know. All right, let's talk about Anubis.
Faces on the Sphinx. He was called Amenemhat II, and he was the third pharaoh of the 12th dynasty, which was a period known as the Middle Kingdom. And the reason why we believe that the head was recarved at all is that it was mutilated at the end of the Old Kingdom when there was a period of terrible turmoil in Egypt and civilization basically collapsed, law and order ceased to exist. And it's well known and accepted by all archaeologists that there were mobs rampaging around Giza, smashing things, especially statues of the pharaohs. And it would appear that they had a go at the head of Anubis. And that's not a difficult thing to do, because if you've got a pointy nose and pointy ears, well, we know what happened to a pointy-headed president the other day. So you can imagine a couple of pointy ears and pointy nose, how easy it is to knock them off. So then you've got a stump. And what do you do when you pull civilization back together again and you get something going called the Middle Kingdom? You look at that stump and you say, I think my face would look good on that.
Well, let's go back to Anubis for a moment. Tell us about Anubis. Who is Anubis? Why would there be this big statue of a dog named Anubis?
Well, Anubis was, as I said a little earlier, the guardian of the dead. He was a deity of the netherworld, and you had to answer to him if you wanted to get past him and become what they call a glorified spirit or an Ok. And what we've worked out, and this was with a great deal of difficulty in connection with Anubis, is the other strange question about the Sphinx: why is he sitting in a hole in the ground? If you've got the largest statue in the world, which it still is today, carved out of a single piece of rock, still, as far as I know, bigger than the faces on Mount Rushmore, then why do you want to put it down in a hole in the ground and hide it? Now, when we've got George Washington's face on Mount Rushmore, it's because it's way up there and you can look at it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea. But if you've got a giant statue of a dog and it's sitting in a hole in the ground, that seems a bit strange, to say the least. So what was going on? And that brings us to the idea that there are signs of water erosion at the Sphinx. And where did they come from? So we've worked out that what was really happening is that Anubis was sitting in a moat, because the Nile in those days came right up to the edge or door of the temple in front of the Sphinx. And it would have been a very simple matter, using the simplest possible water-raising machinery, to fill the moat, which is now known as the Sphinx Pit, with water. And I managed to photograph the evidence of traces of sluice gates and counterweights and water gates and what have you in the channel that leads between the two temples into this Sphinx Pit. So that I believe that they brought the water in at the time of the inundation, which happened once a year, and then they trapped it behind these sluice gates until it came back again 9 months later, and they had themselves a moat. Well, then that would explain the horizontal erosion marks along the Sphinx itself. But why are there vertical erosion marks, as of descending water, on the sides of this moat, which a lot of people have suggested is because of rain in very ancient times, but I don't believe any of that. So because it was just simply too long ago that there was any rain of that kind in Egypt. And the answer to that is really very simple and even mundane, that if you've got all this wind-blown sand coming in over the desert, which is why the Sphinx was covered in sand for most of its existence, it would have gone into the moat, and you would have to dredge the moat the whole time. And when you dredge, then the water comes pouring out along the sides and gouges out these vertical crevasses in the side of the moat, which explains the vertical erosion on the sides of the moat. But you've got horizontal erosion on the Sphinx. And then you've got all the mentions in the ancient texts of what's going on, because it was known as Jackal Lake. And that was where all kinds of important religious ceremonies took place when the pharaoh died.
And people used to wear Anubis masks in rituals. Priests would don a mask that was a head of Anubis. There's a very clear picture of one of these at the Temple of Dendera.
All right, so Anubis is one of the gods of these ancient Egyptians.
He was a guardian, really. He guarded the gate, which led to the netherworld. So he was like a border guard. You couldn't go into the netherworld without passing through his gateway.
And if he didn't like you, then you had to watch out.
It's very fascinating, and this might be, presumably, is where the whole boat ceremony comes from. You know, there are these quite large boats that are now in a little museum by the side of the pyramids, which were found in the sand. Perhaps this is the mythological boat where you take the journey into the netherworld, and Anubis helps you on your way. After all, the afterlife, the netherworld, was to the ancient Egyptians the purpose of life on this side as we know it. Everything led up to this great journey in the boat past Anubis to the netherworld. That's where life really started. He was also Anubis, the god of embalming. So embalming had an equally important role, so that you went on living in the afterlife.
The most ancient texts that survive in Egypt are known as the pyramid texts, because they were carved on the walls of the pyramids of the 5th and 6th dynasties.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak frequently of Jackal Lake and of a giant Anubis beside a causeway at Giza. It's all there in the texts.
It's also in the coffin texts, which were Middle Kingdom, in one of the spells. These coffin texts were not meant to be read by anybody except the person going on the journey to the netherworld. One of the spells describes the great Sphinx. His name is Dogface, whose shape is big.
You know, coffin texts are the kind of opposite of a newspaper, because they have a circulation of one.
Well, I know a few newspapers that are just about there today.
Oh, dear. It's very fascinating stuff. It really is. It's like a giant puzzle, and all we're doing is trying to put together some of the pieces.
Okay, we have a break coming up, and when we come back from this break, one of the questions that I want to get into Anubis a little more, but one of the questions about him that I want us to explore has to do with this. Mythologists tell us that every myth has a kernel of truth in it. So was Anubis perhaps a real, living, breathing person or being at some point? We'll talk about that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Robert and Olivia Temple. when we went away for break, I had asked this question. I said that since mythologists tell us that every myth has a kernel of truth in it, is it possible that Anubis was at one time a real living being, perhaps human, that for whatever reason was depicted as a dog? Do you have any evidence that that was ever a real being? Let me see.
Well, that's
there we go.
Very strange and interesting question. You're getting into areas that are very mysterious indeed, because the most prominent star to the ancient Egyptians was the star Sirius, which was the basis of their calendar, and of course it's generally known as the dog star. Mm-hmm. Now, the dog seems to be more than just a powerful symbol, and I don't want to give your dog, Jonah, too big ideas about himself, but there is something very special about dogs altogether. And as for the Sphinx as Anubis, he was doing more, in my opinion, than merely guarding the dead. He was also guarding a secret. And the entire Giza complex is a very mysterious secret. One of the things that's shown and demonstrated very clearly indeed in the last two chapters of our rather large book, The Sphinx Mystery, it actually is 576 pages long with 375 pictures, is a plan of the Giza Plateau, which I was able to draw on top of the geodetic map of the Egyptian Air Force, measuring all the angles very precisely by that means, because none of the archaeological surveys are reliable, in which I demonstrate that the three main pyramids at Giza and the Sphinx are all related to each other in an unmistakably clear pattern, which nobody had ever seen before. And the point of that is that they were all designed at the same time as a unified design concept. Now, why that was done is another matter, but it is definitely part of an extremely profound resurrection cult. But I wouldn't say it was necessarily just a resurrection cult, because I very strongly believe in the existence of a spiritual dimension, which the Egyptians were recognizing and celebrating, and Giza is, in a sense, its ultimate expression.
All right, now, we have had, over the years, I've had guests on the show who have talked about the Giza Plateau, the complex, and one of the things that they tell us is that it is fictional that the Great Pyramid was ever intended to be used as a tomb, and that it was never used as a tomb, and they cite several things, including the first group, the first person ever to be in the so-called King's Chamber after the pyramid was built and sealed, looking for treasure. And he was an Arab, kind of a warlord. And when they opened the so-called sarcophagus, there was nothing in it. There are also no paintings and hieroglyphs and so forth in the pyramid that would indicate that it was ever intended to be used as a tomb. What do you say about that?
I agree with that completely. I don't believe that the Great Pyramid was ever intended to be a tomb, and certainly was never used as a tomb. And there's countless reasons for that. But the evidence in the Sphinx Mystery strengthens that belief, because it shows that all three of the pyramids were built, or at least designed, at the same time. So the tomb theory of that you've got these whimsical pharaohs, and one of them says one day, you know, I think I'd like a pyramid. And then another pharaoh comes along and he says, well, you know, I'd like a pyramid too. And then another one later says, well, what about me? I want my own pyramid. And so these three guys have got these pyramids to stick themselves in, you know. But it can't have been like that, because the evidence in our book shows conclusively that the three pyramids were part of a unified design along with the Sphinx. So you can't have these three pharaohs coming along doing that. And anyway, one thing nobody normally mentions is that they weren't consecutive, any of those three pharaohs. There were pharaohs in between. And so the whole thing is just a nonsense about the tomb theory.
It seems like it's a giant engineering feat, that the purpose of which is still not understood, not even remotely understood. It is a complete mystery, and there's not even any way that they could have got a sarcophagus into the king's chamber. So how did that sarcophagus get there?
Well, there's
what
also...
What was in it? Was it some strange liquid? Was it semen? Was it something that was meant to help you live forever? Nobody knows.
One of the things
Olivia
that...
extremely important, which is that the sarcophagus inside the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid is actually too big, and it's one big chunk of granite, to fit through the passage to get into the chamber. Therefore, the chamber had to be built round it. Just think of that, Kevin.
Mm. Well, and also this. I saw in a documentary that was produced by Ken Klein, an archaeologist who showed an example of, I believe, first of all, that standard Egyptology says that the Great Pyramid is from the 5th dynasty. I think that's correct.
It's generally thought to be 4th dynasty.
4th dynasty.
I think it's actually a bit older than that.
Okay. So in the 3rd dynasty, you look at pyramids that were built, known to be built for sure by pharaohs, and they're all crumbling and falling down. You look at the ones in the 5th dynasty, and they're all crumbling and falling down. Are the 4th dynasty, they're all crumbling and falling down. But you look at the Great Pyramid that's in the dynasty in between, and here's this majestic, not just the Great Pyramid, but the other two as well, majestic, well-built pyramid that's not crumbling and falling down, and has weathered time and weathered the weather. The archaeologist in that documentary asked an interesting question. He said, how is it that in the dynasty before, in the century before, they didn't know how to build this, then suddenly they do, and then suddenly in the next dynasty they don't?
Yeah, that's exactly the point that it should be raised. It's like there was some huge collapse of their technology. Something happened, which meant that they could no longer do this.
Well, that's right. But it's even stranger than that, because according to the conventional chronologies, which all Egyptians believe in as the Holy Writ, there was something called the Second Dynasty, which was succeeded clearly by something called the Third Dynasty. And Olivia and I were uniquely fortunate to be able to visit the tomb of the last king of the Second Dynasty. It has a long, complicated name called Khosrowkamui. And it was only exposed for 2 weeks, and we happened to be there at the right time because we were part of a dating project that dated that tomb, actually. When I saw the tomb chamber of this tomb, of the last king of the Second Dynasty, it was just a tiny little place with some unbelievably crudely hacked out limestone blocks that looked like they'd been cut by a chimpanzee or something. And then the next thing that's meant to happen is the so-called step pyramid at Saqqara was built by the first king of the Third Dynasty. Now, we know that the first king of the Third Dynasty buried the last king of the Second Dynasty because his jar ceilings and things were found in that tomb that I just mentioned by the guy who dug it out, who's a German. And so the step pyramid at Saqqara contains 1 million tons of stone, and a beautifully constructed pyramid. Now, how do you get any kind of logical connection here? Because we're talking about 20 or 30 years difference in time between these two things. This tiny little tomb chamber made out of the most appallingly badly cut limestone, as I say, looked like monkeys made it. And then 20 years later, you've got this gigantic step pyramid. What's going on? And so this is a subject I actually deal with at very great length in my next book that I haven't finished yet, and it won't be published for another year, which is called Egyptian Dawn, where I get to grips with this, and I give a full report on all of that. But the whole question of which pyramids were really built first and who did them and why was it that some people could do it and other people couldn't do it, and was there a tremendous disconnection between the northern Egyptian and southern Egyptian cultures, whereby one had stone technology and the other didn't, etc. All these questions are never raised in Egyptology, or if they are, and in fact this was raised on two or three occasions by some well-known Egyptologists in the past, but covered up now and ignored. All of these issues are considered too disturbing because Egyptology basically is now an ossified system whereby nobody challenges anything because nobody's supposed to rock the boat. And if you rock the boat, you don't get a job. And people of large intellect no longer go into Egyptology because everybody's just become like a kind of civil servant or social worker or something, that the people with the big brains aren't there anymore. The great Egyptologists of the past are all dead, and the guys who've taken their place are just mostly twerps. And we all know that twerps can't think, and all they can do is they can adhere to some rigid doctrine and penalize anyone who deviates from it. And so there's no fresh thinking going on in Egyptology anymore. So people are blind to all these issues, and they're not solving them.
Well, one big issue that they're blind to, and at least from my point of view, is the fact that according to standard Egyptology, the level of technology available at the time they say the Great Pyramid was built says that the Egyptians had bronze tools. And bronze...
In fact, they were better than that because I've done a study of the metallurgy of ancient Egypt. And in fact, as early as the first dynasty, they had means of hardening copper with arsenic, 2% of arsenic in the alloy, which actually made it harder than bronze.
Why haven't any of these instruments? There aren't any left that people don't seem to have found measuring rods or things for digging or angles or why haven't they found any of these?
Well,
things?
And they also, why haven't they found, look, the Egyptians drew pictures of absolutely everything, painted pictures of all their daily life, and there are none regarding the building of the Great Pyramid. We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. My guests this evening, Robert Temple and Olivia Temple. And let me throw that question out again, or that comment out again, and get you to comment on it. There don't seem to be any hieroglyphics or any paintings or carvings showing the building of the Great Pyramid.
Yes, that's certainly true. And even more puzzling is how on earth did they ever design such a vast thing as the Giza Plateau, or even how did they design such a vast thing as one of those pyramids without big plans? And what were the plans on? Because they would have had to be bigger than papyrus was capable of. So this was probably done on leather, which would be this an entire ox hide. But even that you'd have trouble squeezing it all on there. And to get the precision of measurement which they had, where things are down to the millimeter, on such a gigantic scale, because after all, the Great Pyramid covers 13 acres of ground, it's a feat that's almost, well, it's beyond modern engineering capabilities. You wouldn't think that anybody could do it in ancient times. The whole thing is totally baffling from that point of view.
Well, there's always the possibility that it could have been somebody else from the other side. Maybe it was an extraterrestrial element that enabled this to be done, just to put the cat among the pigeons. The other thing I wanted to mention was, Kevin, about the hollow cavities, the chambers in the Sphinx.
Mm-hmm, because that's part of the complex as well.
Well, in a way, of course, some of them were probably natural spaces in the limestone, but even early travelers, as early as the 1580s and thereabouts, talked about the hollowness of the Sphinx, and that there were actually secret passages by means of which heathen priests entered the head and spoke to the people, making announcements by babbling.
I've actually crawled inside the Sphinx, which is more than most people can say, and there is an entrance at the very back of the Sphinx.
There's a photograph of Robert climbing out of the Sphinx's ass, actually. It doesn't go very far.
Well, Olivia's always taking these compromising photos of me in strange positions, but climbing out of the Sphinx's ass, you know, is normally the kind of thing you would do in the privacy of your own home. But
I was worried about you doing it because I don't think you were meant to, and I thought you were going to be arrested. So I was all right for you.
Yeah, tell us about that.
But I was actually standing there looking rather pathetic and grinning amiably at the guards who were standing around, hoping you wouldn't cause the whole thing to cave in and collapse.
Well, and that's a very serious danger, because what happens when you go inside the Sphinx is that there's this hole down beneath the Sphinx, which I call the rump tunnel. It ends in a kind of cavity where you could have two people could stand, but where I think that people used to curl up and spend the night, have a sacred dream. It's carved out of the solid rock, this cavity, and I believe that it's by no means original. It was long after it ceased to be a moat, and probably used in the Greek and Roman times when that kind of thing was fashionable. But then, and it goes down about 20 feet and stops, doesn't connect with anything. But if you look upwards from that, you discover, nobody ever mentions this, well, because nobody ever sees it, that there is another tunnel that goes up and round the right side of the Sphinx's haunch. And now I tried to crawl up there, but it's very dangerous because it's supported by wooden struts which have been placed in there to stop it collapsing. And there was a very serious possibility that it might have collapsed on me and I would have been crushed inside the Sphinx, a fate that didn't appeal to me. So,
but it's a great way to go, imagine.
Well, I don't know.
crushed by the Sphinx. Rest in peace.
And couldn't I at least be crushed by the Sphinx's head? Do I have to be crushed by the Sphinx's ass?
Well, it serves you right.
All right, now let...
That's what's known as making an ass of yourself.
All right, let me ask you this. How did you get permission to go inside?
The people would have, in ancient times, consulted the Sphinx like an oracle, and therefore it's very likely that priests would have crept inside, and with a system of pipes and things, they would have been able to reply to people and make them feel that their god was answering them.
All right,
you know,
Robert.
People would go and offer a sacrifice of goose, for instance, in order to be told what they wanted to hear.
Robert, how did you get permission to go inside?
Now, the idea that there is a secret chamber, actual chamber, rather than the hole I've described, beneath the Sphinx is something that has preoccupied a lot of people, and I think rightly, because there actually is one. And I found the proof of this because earlier Olivia mentioned 281 years of the traveler's reports of what there's a total of 2,000 years of reports, but there's 281 years of published traveler's reports which describe eyewitness accounts of people entering this chamber. And this was stated in book after book, and some of these people were archaeologists as well. And what there was a vertical shaft going down at the back of the haunches of the Sphinx. Now, this is not the same as the rump tunnel. And it went down to a genuine chamber, which was a burial chamber, where there were traces of a coffin left. And this chamber was covered in hieroglyphics. So it's a great pity we can't get in there now and read those, and then we'd know who was there, presumably. But it was all sealed up with cement in 1926 by a rather dim Frenchman called Émile Barrès, who was a kind of fixer for the government who wanted to pretty things up for tourists. He didn't like holes, so he thought, well, you know, I'm going to fill that one up and make this Sphinx look good, because the rump had actually split off from the body completely by that stage. And he just filled the whole thing up with cement and covered it with some stones. And this is all shown very clearly in our book with lots of photos and so on, before and after shots. And so the descriptions that were published by these people give precise measurements. They measured the distance of this shaft from the head and from the back, and they give the exact size of the rectangular opening that led down into the shaft, and they describe the chamber, and it's all there in the book. And these are things that I dug out through my research abilities in libraries, which no Egyptologist alive today knew about. They didn't even know about one of them, much less 280 years worth of them. So what we've got at the back of our book is every description of the Sphinx that was published from the time of Pliny in Roman times, 1st century A.D., up until 1837, when we got sick of it and stopped.
All right. Now, how did you get permission to go inside the Sphinx?
Don't ask.
Too late. I already did.
We got sort of semi-permission, but once we were in a certain area, we waited until not too many people were looking. You know how it is.
Well, we
did get permission for the basic research mm-hmm. in that area, but we didn't get permission to climb in the Sphinx.
No, we didn't specifically ask for that. You see, we have had official permission from what they call the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt to work in the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, which we did. And I was able to make many very, very, very interesting discoveries in those places. The Sphinx Temple, which is directly in front of the Sphinx, is never open to the public, and indeed it's not even really open to archaeologists unless you make a big fuss, and then you might get turned down. And we got into the closed portions of the Valley Temple, which is the one next to it, where nobody had been in there in so long they had to smash the locks with hammers because they'd rusted shut and they didn't have any keys.
Well, the inspector, we had two inspectors with us, a woman and a man, and the chap was very excited to go with Robert because he himself had never been on this rooftop that they scrambled around, and they were like two little boys or two goats scrambling all over the place. And the woman stayed with me and looked rather annoyed when they were hours away.
You can't let me loose on the roof of an Egyptian temple and expect me to come back anytime soon, because and I'm a great one for crawling down cobra holes and getting all covered in spiders and looking in the foundations of these ancient structures, where I discover all kind of peculiar things, as you can imagine.
Leaving me behind to pass the time of day with somebody who says it's time to leave. So I desperately try to think of things to say, like, have you ever had a drink of alcohol?
Okay, we have to take a break. We come back, I've got a couple of questions, and then we'll open the telephone lines. We'll be back, folks, right after this. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Robert and Olivia Temple. We're talking about the Sphinx Mystery, a fabulous, fabulous study and book that they have produced. As I said, I've got a couple of questions before we open the telephone lines. Now, when you went in to these temples that are closed to the public, did you discover anything that was really a kind of an aha moment where you said, aha, now this makes sense?
Yes, we've discovered many such things. Most of them are not described in the Sphinx Mystery, but when you're able to really explore some of these ancient structures properly, you do find things that you don't expect. I can assure you of that. And there is also the phenomenon of false perspective, which the Egyptians were masters of, that you think you've got, say, a straight wall, for instance, and then if you measure it out carefully, you find it's not really straight, and they're concealing things all the time. Really, the Egyptians were very tricky, and you might think the Sphinx is looking right into the center of the Sphinx Temple, which is in front of it, but in fact, it's not really. If you look at it from the air, you see it's doing something different. That is in the Sphinx Mystery. So everything about the Egyptian monuments is intriguing and bizarre. I can really assure you of that.
But I think what we thought of and think of as the drainage channels was probably an aha moment, wasn't it?
Well, the fact is that the water going in and out of this moat was through this channel between these two temples, and the evidence which I photographed of all of the bolt holes and counterweight slots and things to do with the sluice gates has now been covered up. The trouble is that when you run a tourist business, which is what the Egyptian economy partly is, you've got to make everything kind of neat and tidy, or at least you think you do, and you do what you call restoration. Now, the problem with restoration is it can very quickly turn into Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And so the particular evidence of which I've got full photographs, and the full color ones are on the book's website, which is sphinxmystery.info, they show things that are now covered by this restoration. So all the evidence gets wiped away, and a lot of the evidence about the Sphinx itself has been destroyed, not just the entrance to the chamber beneath the Sphinx being filled with cement, like I said earlier. And so what we say in the book is the Sphinx is really more Botoxed and got more cosmetic surgery than anybody in Hollywood could ever dream of. And it's a shame, really, because it now looks like mutton dressed as lamb.
Do you think we're ever going to know what might still be hidden inside one of the chambers of the Sphinx?
Probably not, I would say, unless in years to come the restoration becomes shabby and falls off and decays and exposes some of these holes again, in which case it could be climbed into. But at the moment it's completely sealed up with new blocks covering every inch of it. So the secret of the Sphinx stays a secret for future generations
to
discover.
Some thought about how we could get to the chamber beneath the Sphinx without having to tear out all the cement from 1926, which actually is harder than the rock itself, so that would make a lot of damage. And you'd have to do it from the bedrock surface at the foot of beside the Sphinx, because you couldn't really get all that cement out now. It would be impossible. But I do believe that by following a crack in the bedrock, a fissure that we have identified, and you can see on certain plans, that if you could get into that, you could probably get into this from round the side of the Sphinx, enter the chamber, and then you could read the hieroglyphics inside the chamber and you'd know what they say.
Well, there might even be a tunnel from another place, as some of the early travelers suspected, leading from another part of the Giza Plateau to the underneath side of the Sphinx itself.
Well, there certainly are other tunnels, because there's a chamber between the paws of the Sphinx, which anybody who goes and stands between the paws of the Sphinx can readily see. It's got an iron plate over it. All you have to do is pull the iron plate up and look down, and there's a chamber, which, of course, I did, because I'm a very nosy person. And that was first discovered in 1817, when the front of the Sphinx was excavated by a very remarkable Italian chap named Giambattista Caviglia. And there was a man he knew who was the British consul in Egypt at the time, called Henry Salt. And Henry Salt was a very strange fellow. He was providing some of the money to pay for all those workers that cleared all the sand so that Caviglia could get down to the bedrock in front of the Sphinx. And Salt was another one of these people who liked to tidy things up. And he started blocking up passages and entrances himself as early as 1817. And he was very severely criticized for this by the French chap who was out there, who was a count called de Forbin. And he published an account, which I reproduce in the book, in which he accused Salt of blocking up things that should have been archaeologically explored, and accused him, you know, of basically being an ignorant Philistine, which probably he was in his way. Of course, the two men did hate each other, which added to the acrimony. But that's just in the between the paws of the Sphinx, and we know about it. And then round behind the left shoulder of the Sphinx was an entrance to another chamber inside the Sphinx. And there are photos in existence that show people standing inside it. And that was blocked up in 1926 by Barrès, and I've got a photo of Olivia standing right in front of it so you can see exactly where it is.
I do urge people, if they're interested, to look at the website, because the photographs are reproduced in color there, whereas in the book they're in sepia, in two-tone. And the website is sphinxmystery.info.
And let me say to our listeners that
the chamber between the paws of the Sphinx that I say everybody knows about it. In fact, nobody knows about it, but they should know about it because anybody can see it if they look. We know that Henry Salt blocked up the passage that led from that, but we don't know where the passage led because, of course, he blocked it. And that would be a very easy thing to unblock because he would have just blocked it with in a simple way with bricks and basic cement. It wouldn't be like the later blockages, and it could easily be unblocked, but I don't know why no one's done this. What's wrong with everybody? Why don't they make a serious effort to really find all these chambers and tunnels in and under and around the Sphinx? Because it's all there waiting to be discovered.
Okay, let me say very quickly to our audience, as we have started doing, it's a little bit new, but we've started doing it this way. Instead of putting a link, a text link, to our guest website, you just click on their picture. So if you click on Robert's photograph on my website, you click on his photograph, it will take you to his website. And if you click on Olivia's, it will take you to her website, and you can see some of those wonderful pictures that she has painted. And if you have any interest at all in gardening, you really ought to see that section of the website as well. It's pretty fantastic. All right, we're going to open up the telephone lines and allow our audience to call in. And if you have a question or a comment for our guest, the telephone number is 1-602-539-9580. If it would be long distance for you and you're not on a calling plan where you can call long distance at no extra charge, you have to pay for long distance, use our toll-free number. And that number is 888-223-4599. All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
How are we doing?
Good.
I just wanted to interact. They're finding pyramids worldwide here recently. You know, they thought they were volcanoes or mountains and stuff, and they're turning around finding them. So this is more a worldwide phenomena, and that there's a lot more out there to see. You know, if Egypt, if we can't, you know, get into Egypt, it's so protected. You know, maybe some of these other sites can give us the answers with less resistance. I've seen Jerry Wells, I think it's in Peru, where he said he called it a Sphinx, that was paramount to the one that's on Mars with the face.
Mm-hmm.
I found that quite interesting. And I just wonder what your guests would think that would be a smart thing to do.
All right. Let's find out. What about it, Robert? Olivia?
I'm not aware of a Sphinx in Peru. I'm sorry I haven't heard about that. But what the caller said about there being pyramids around the world is certainly true. There are many such shapes, and some of them of vast size, around the world. And, in fact, the largest pyramid in the world is at Cholula in Mexico. But it's largely earth covered in stone, and it's not in such great shape. But it is actually, in bulk, larger than the Great Pyramid. And there is an artificial earth mound right here in England where we are at the moment, called Silbury Hill,
mm-hmm.
in Wiltshire, which is quite near Avebury and Stonehenge, which is equal in bulk, more or less, to the second pyramid at Giza. And its purpose was similar to one of the uses of the pyramids at Giza, which was getting an accurate calendar through studying the sun shadows, because in order to determine the exact length of the year, which is not an easy thing to do because it's not an even number of days, you get a fraction at the end. That's why we have something called leap year, but leap year is not really accurate either. In order to get it absolutely accurate, you have to measure extremely closely the shadows cast by very, very, very high structures or poles.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Great Pyramid is probably the greatest shadow caster of all time, because using the North Meridian line to study the varying lengths of the noon shadow, you would be able to determine down to a tiny fraction of a day the exact length of the solar year. And they did the similar thing at Silbury Hill, because they had a sort of giant tree trunk sticking up out of the flattened top of this huge artificial mound. And we think that these large structures were used all over the world in order to try to get an accurate calendar. That was one thing that they were all about.
All right, let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
How are you tonight?
Doing well, sir. I need you to speak into your phone good and loud for us.
Yeah, I'm not hearing you very loud through the phone either. What about Dr. Schock and John Anthony West and their research in Egypt on the Sphinx and the Pyramid?
Okay, thanks for the call. What about that? Dr.
Well,
Robert Schock
very nice
and...
It's to hear somebody from Kentucky, because that's where I come from.
Yeah, what about Dr. Robert Schock's work on that? I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a geologist.
Yes, I've never met Robert Schock, although I have met John Anthony West on numerous occasions. And he's discussed at some length in our book. You can read that. And so is Schock, for that matter. In fact, I think that Schock has made a number of very interesting observations. And I don't agree with what they call the ancient rain theory, though, because they deserve the credit for noticing the water erosion at the Sphinx, which a lot of people have tried not to notice, and it called attention to it in a big way. But they've come up with an alternative explanation for it, which is that it was caused by rain, but the rain had to be in 10,000 B.C. or earlier. In fact, West thinks that the Sphinx is apparently 35,000 B.C. or something like that. He once told me 25,000, 35,000 B.C. I don't know quite why he thought that. But I don't believe that the ancient rain is the answer, because as I described earlier, the Sphinx pit was a moat filled with water brought in from the Nile at the inundation period, long before the Aswan Dam existed, when the water came right up to the entrance to the Sphinx temple. And so all that erosion is, as I described earlier, explained by there being this moat around the Sphinx filled with water. And the vertical erosion in the sides was from dredging the sand out of the moat, and the water would pour downwards. But if you look at the Sphinx carefully, the erosion is all horizontal, not vertical, and that's because it was sitting in water.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, hello. This is Kevin calling from Northern Alberta.
Hello, Kevin.
Hi. How's everybody doing tonight?
Outstanding.
Great. Well, good. Yeah, very interesting topic. Obviously, you put a lot of thought into your book, and I look forward to reading it. Were you aware that if you stand at the Sphinx on the summer solstice and look between the Great Pyramid and its neighbor, that the sun sets directly between the two?
Well, I haven't observed the summer solstice sunset because it's a bit hot to be out there at that time of year, and I've never been there then. But I have made a very astounding observation of the winter solstice sunset at Giza. And you'll find photographs and an account of that in the book. And I first called attention to it in an earlier book in the year 2000 called The Crystal Sun. What we discovered in, I think it was 1998, we first noticed this at the winter solstice sunset, that the Pyramid of Khafre, at the precise moment of sunset, casts a shadow on the south face of the Great Pyramid, which is at the same angle, the same slope, as the passages inside the structure. The ascending and descending passages are both at the same angle, known as the golden angle of 26 degrees, 33 minutes, and 54 seconds. And the shadow cast at the winter solstice sunset onto the pyramid by the one beside it is that angle, the golden angle. And it was the golden angle, as explained in very great detail in the Sphinx Mystery, which was the key to the entire Giza complex and was the central sacred angle of Egyptian religion. It was the angle of resurrection. And so the winter solstice sunset creates a phenomenon at Giza which is the largest and most dramatic display of a solstice phenomenon in any archaeological monument situation anywhere in the world.
Yes, I have to agree.
Have you been there, Kevin, from Alberta, at the summer solstice?
No, I've had a friend that was there, and unfortunately I haven't had the opportunity to travel to Egypt yet.
You must. You've got to do it.
It's one of my biggest dreams. Also, in the winter solstice, and I'm just reading this now from a webpage, it seems that if you're standing at the entrance of the Great Pyramid and you're looking at the head of the Sphinx, the sun rises on the left side and traces right around the head and then sets directly on the right side.
Like a halo.
Yeah, like a halo. It goes traces right around from the entrance of the Great Pyramid. So, I don't know, one of these years, maybe I'll be able to get down there and witness some of these coincidences.
I think you must, and there are various tours of with guides who know about these things who can take you, and you'd really enjoy it.
One of the problems with observing the winter solstice shadow that I mentioned is that they chase you out of Giza before sunset.
Mm.
So I had a lot of trouble viewing this, and I became very adept at evading the antiquities police on their camels, because they chase you on camels, in order to try to prolong my stay there long enough to observe the shadow properly before leaving. Because, you know, they want to clear the place before it gets dark, for obvious mm-hmm. reasons. Mm-hmm. They don't want anybody staying there overnight, for instance.
All right,
you can get in with special groups at night into the Giza precinct. And in fact, we've been inside the Great Pyramid at night, which is wonderful because the tourist crowds aren't there. But you have to make special arrangements to do this. That's the only time you can really study the interior of the pyramid properly, when there aren't thousands of people squeezing past you.
All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Clay from Arkansas.
Hello, Clay.
I wonder, I'm having trouble hearing you a little bit.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Edward Casey said there was a chamber in one of the paws and that solved the Earth's problems. I mean, the questions of the universe. Well, anyway, has anybody ever found that one? And I'll hang up and let you give the answer.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, we mentioned this in the book about Edward Casey's Edgar Casey's suggestion that there was a chamber beneath one of the paws of the Sphinx. Now, I already mentioned that there is a chamber between the paws of the Sphinx, and that there was a passage leading from it, which was blocked up in 1817 by Henry Salt. Now, we don't know which direction that passage went, but it may have gone towards one of the two paws of the Sphinx. I believe that Edgar Casey said there's a chamber beneath the right paw of the Sphinx. For all we know, that passage that was blocked up in 1817 went there, and it's by no means unlikely that there are other chambers beneath the Sphinx, and one of them could easily be beneath the right paw of the Sphinx.
All right, we have a break coming up in less than a minute, but when we come back, I want to... we'll leave the telephone lines open, but I do want to sort of get into something that Olivia mentioned earlier, and that is the possibility of extraterrestrial intervention. And what I want to find out is, obviously that theory is out there. You're out crawling around in and on the Sphinx, and... you had to have come to some sort of a conclusion, or at least a speculation, about the extraterrestrial component to all of this. So we'll get into that a little bit when we get back, and we'll open up the phone lines again for you. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Robert Temple and Olivia Temple. Amazing individuals. Just visit their websites. You'll see what I mean. And then they have written an amazing book. It is several amazing books. This one that we're talking about is The Mystery, or The Sphinx Mystery. And when we went away for the break, I had brought up the subject of an extraterrestrial component in as one of the theories for how all of this Giza plateau happened. What do you say about that?
Well, this is not discussed in the Sphinx Mystery at all, But people who are interested in this should look at my earlier book, which is called The Sirius Mystery, and that's S-I-R-I-U-S, which is readily obtainable in paperback. And it deals with the extraterrestrial question. Now, we're talking about a book on this subject that was actually favorably reviewed in Nature, which is a leading scientific publication. So it's not just sort of full of wild speculations, but it's a book dealing with evidence, very, very strange evidence, that suggests a hypothesis of the possibility of extraterrestrial contact with Earth in the distant past. Now, if you wanted to apply it to Giza, if you get The Sirius Mystery in its contemporary edition, because it was revised and reissued in 1998 with 50% more material, as it was my first book, but I expanded it greatly. In the first chapter, you will find no less than four numerical comparisons, correlations between aspects of the three Giza pyramids and the three stars of the Sirius system. That's Sirius A, Sirius B, and Sirius C. And that you'll find that these are accurate to within two or three or sometimes four decimal points. So this is numerical correspondences. Now, there isn't one, there isn't two, there isn't three, there's four. And so it's always better to have more than one of something.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes less and less likely that we're talking about coincidence. You could say that all of these four correspondences are pure coincidence, if you're so inclined. On the other hand, if you're not so inclined, you might raise one or two eyebrows, or ten if you've got ten eyebrows, and say, what's going on here? Now, I would recommend that people read The Sirius Mystery if they want to find out about that, because the universe is clearly full of intelligent life. It's out there. We now know what a few years ago we didn't even really know, that the universe is full of habitable planets. Everybody admits that now. So, if they're habitable, we presume they're inhabited. And if they're inhabited, then some people might have found ways to get around between the stars. And it wouldn't be an unusual thing at all for extraterrestrials to go coasting around and visit this planet, that planet, and whatever, and say, howdy, folks. Like you would have said, as a boy in Texas, Kevin, howdy there, y'all. Although I expect that the extraterrestrials don't quite have the southern drawl that you have.
I could teach it to them, no problem whatsoever. Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Rick from Kentucky.
Hi, Rick.
I had a kind of a comment and a question. We probably crossed paths about 40 years ago. I used to eat at Colonel Sanders' restaurant in Corbin, Kentucky all the time. So thought I'd throw that in there. What percentage?
Well, it's nice to hear. You're the second person from Kentucky to phone in, you know. I tell you, we Kentuckians are everywhere, and we got a plan to take over the world one of these days, haven't we, Rick?
Hillbillies are going to take over, no doubt.
That's right. I like a good old hillbilly.
What percentage of the finds would you say have been found in Egypt, and percentage-wise, I always figure we probably only found maybe 40 or 50% of what's there. And do you think there's a concerted effort from the Antiquities Committee over there to keep us from finding something? Is that possible?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I would say we've probably only found 5%.
Okay.
But when you think about the Antiquities Service over in Egypt, a few years ago I asked them what kind of budget they had, and they only had a budget of of $2 million a year to look after all the monuments of Egypt. Now, just think about that. Most of these countries full of ruins, and Greece is the same, they have no money to dig anything. They rely upon foreign schools to come in, the British, the Americans, and in Egypt they've got Poles and Czechs. all sorts of people floating around, the Germans, who have money, and they come in and they dig. They get permission, they get a license, and they dig. Because the Egyptians do very little digging because they can't afford it, because they actually haven't got any money.
Yeah.
Now, under the present regime of Zahi Hawass, the strange fellow who now runs things in Egypt, in the antiquities field, he's made life very difficult for the foreign teams to go and dig. That's all very well if you've got lots of money to pay for the Egyptians, who are very fine archaeologists, to go and dig in their place. But because they can't afford to dig either, an awful lot of digging is not taking place. He's put in a lot of strange rules that you have to write everything in Arabic, and of course, people from around the world don't all know Arabic, and also you can't publish your results anymore. You have to give them to him first, and he publishes them with his name on, and so he gets the credit for all your work, and a lot of foreign archaeologists are incredibly fed up with this, and the system's kind of ground to a halt in Egypt, really, under that regime. So there's not a lot being discovered out there compared to what could be. I've always maintained that a lot more money ought to be poured into the whole business of digging up the secrets of Egypt. And I get really fed up with a lot of stupid, silly, rich people who go around writing checks to miscellaneous charities to make themselves feel good.
Yeah.
And they don't even know where the money's going, but it's mostly on janitors. When they could easily... How many thousands of Americans have got a couple of million dollars to spare? Well, at least they did before the economic collapse. And they could easily have written a check that could double the size of the Egyptian antiquities budget and get something really done. But they haven't got any brains or imagination. And so nobody's ever done it. Makes me fed up. So there's no money, basically. There's no money. Nobody's doing it properly.
To leave probably some of the biggest discoveries of the century and leave them under the sand and not even look for them.
I agree with that, but I'll tell you, I think some of the biggest discoveries of all time have already been made, and they're not left under the sand. They're under lock and key, and we're not being told.
The second part of my question was, do you think they found something, and that's the reason we're not going in? They don't want to let the information out. Thank you, Robert. Olivia.
Nice to hear from all you folks from Kentucky. Howdy, Kentucky. I certainly miss the chicken.
Well, what do you think about that? What about the discoveries that are alleged to have been found? Look, people talk about these things. It has to be pretty much speculation because... they're under lock and key, and yet there are people who say that they have found things in Egypt that are of extraterrestrial nature, or at least confirm the extraterrestrial hypothesis. They're under lock and key. What do you think?
Well, I don't have any knowledge of anything of that kind, but there are certainly things, very remarkable things, which have been found in Egypt, which are not accessible, and I have had access to quite a lot of them, and have seen them with my own eyes. So I know that they're there because I've been into them. And for instance, I had an adventure exploring the Osiris shaft at Giza, which is 150 feet down beneath the Khafre Causeway, and that's pretty amazing. And nobody ever goes down there except Zahi Hawass. And I did some work there, in fact, which that remains unpublished. And I've done some studies of some of the more remarkable structures in Egypt. These are all things that were done with full permission from the what they call the Supreme Council. And that's all unpublished so far, and a lot of it will be discussed in the book that's following the Sphinx mystery in about a year, called Egyptian Dawn, where some very, very amazing things that I saw, which are under, as he says, lock and key, are described. But nothing that I would put into the extra terrestrial category.
Did I understand you to say earlier that whatever you write about your discoveries in Egypt, now you have to turn them over to Zawi Hawass, and he publishes that under his name? Is that correct?
That's correct.
You know, that's sort of like Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley has all these songs. There are all these songs out there that have his name on them as though he wrote them, and he wrote almost none of them. That was the deal. If Elvis is going to record your song, it gets published with his name on it. So Zawi's trying to be the Elvis of Egypt, I guess.
Well, they said Elvis is not dead, and I think Zawi Hawass proves that. He's a kind of Elvis. If I told you too much about Zawi Hawass, it might become very embarrassing, so I better be a bit discreet rather than, you know, one doesn't need more enemies.
Well, yeah, you may want to return to Egypt sometime.
You want to know some of the things.
This chamber business under the paw, there was also a chamber discovered in the Great Pyramid by, I believe it was a German archaeologist. As soon as I could be wrong about that, but I think it was German. But as soon as they discovered this chamber, they put a little robot with a camera on it, and it went into found the chamber. But as soon as they discovered it, Zawi shut things down, and they were not allowed to open it. And he said that it was going to be opened, and that they would reveal it all to the world. And that was years ago, and it's never happened. What's up with that?
That was one of the shafts going up from the King's Chamber. There was a film made of the little robot, wasn't there, going up it, mm-hmm. crawling up like a little spacecraft, and it got to a point where there was a partition or a little door blocking the rest of the shaft.
Then they finally pushed the door and went beyond, but we haven't heard a great deal since then. Zawi Hawass is the kind of person who likes to have complete control over information. And if he finds something, he wants to sit on it until he decides what he wants to say about it, and he wants to be the one. So nobody else is going to get a chance to say anything about anything until he's had his say. And if he hasn't made up his mind what he wants to say, then nothing gets said.
All right, we'll have to wait till we come back from this break for us to say more. And when we come back, the telephone lines are open, and we'll take your calls on the other side of this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Let me say briefly that the music that you hear on this show is all from independent artists. And you can find their music at garageband.com and music.podshow.com. That's where we get it. Those are two great sites. Fill your iPod and just enjoy, all right? Doesn't cost you anything to go over there and grab some music. All right, now, my guests are Robert and Olivia Temple, and the telephone number is 602-539-9580, unless it costs you long-distance money to call us. And if it does, use our toll-free number, 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA, you're outside of Canada, you can use our flash message feature. You just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, and you'll see the link. It's in green letters. It says flash message, and you can send me your question or comment. I'll read it on the air, and we'll ask our guests to comment on it. One thing that I haven't asked either of you yet, and I think I should, is first, Why did you decide to do this book, and how long have you been working on this?
We've worked on the book for about 10 years. And, Olivia, why don't you tell them what we thought when we first saw the Sphinx?
It really evolved, this book, on its own accord. It was like the Sphinx was a collaborator and was smiling that enigmatic smile at us and saying, go on, let's do the book. And it just happened. We were so puzzled by it and by the strange incongruity of the small head and the long body and the fact that we didn't see a lion and the fact that we saw this dog that we then discovered was Anubis. It just developed on its own. We started looking up the early travelers' tales and became hooked on the subject.
Do you know why I asked the question?
That in terms of the early travelers' tales of the eyewitness reports of the chamber beneath the Sphinx, that was not an easy thing to find because nobody knew they existed, and I came across one really by chance while researching something else that was published in 1715, and it referred to earlier ones, but it didn't say who had written them, or I had no lead other than something that was about Egypt published prior to 1715. So I had to go to the British Library and live there for a few months trying to find, by going through everything that was ever published about Egypt, really, these accounts.
I always think of Robert as a cosmic detective. He's the sort of cosmic Indiana Jones, Sherlock Holmes, and I'm his Dr. Watson. And in this case, we took on much more than we realized, and this is why it took us getting on for 10 years to do the book.
Sherlock Holmes should have been lucky enough to have a Dr. Watson as pretty as you.
The reason that I asked the question earlier about was there a kernel of truth in this mythology about Anubis and was it a real person is because Anubis is pictured in many paintings and carvings around Egypt as being having a man's body and then the head of a dog.
I think my feeling about that is that it was actually an Anubis mask that a priest was wearing. Those pictures represent a man with an Anubis mask which he was wearing for a specific ritual of which we don't know what that would have been. What do you think, Robert?
Well, yes, in fact, one of those Anubis masks actually survives. I think it's in a German museum, and we know someone who's made a replica of it and figured out how you would wear it, and you would have eye holes to see where you're going in the neck of the Anubis head. And the Egyptian priests were always wearing these animal heads in their ceremonies, which was kind of spooky, but a lot of the images carved on the walls of the temples and pictures in the tombs and so on, which people think are images of gods, are not images of gods. They're images of priests wearing these animal heads. And so it's not gods with animal heads half the time. It's priests with animal heads. People mm-hmm. tend not to realize that.
But they did think of gods as having interchangeable animal heads and bird heads, didn't they?
Well, these are purely symbolic. I mean, they didn't literally believe that any deity existed with an animal head or a bird head.
No, it was representative.
Yeah.
By the way, the Anubis mask at the moment is in London. There's a big exhibition on of hats. And the mask that Robert was saying is in Germany is in London at the moment.
Well, that's my local information service just told me that this minute. We've got to go along pretty quick and see that.
We have. I have to try and stop you from breaking the glass to get to it to try it on.
I'm never satisfied until I've touched it and smelt it.
Yeah, well, I'm not going with you.
All right, now, in your previous book, The Serious Mystery, did you cover in that book the Dagon tribe and their very interesting allegiance to the Sirius and their ritual every, I think it's every 40 years, every 50 years?
Well, the Sirius Mystery, which was the first book I ever wrote, but which I revised and expanded by 50% in 1998, it started with the evidence of this tribe in Mali in West Africa called the Dogon, D-O-G-O-N. And it's truly bizarre that they knew about the invisible companion of Sirius, known as Sirius B, which goes around it every 50 years, and they did diagrams of its orbit. They knew its orbital period. They even knew that Sirius B was a super-heavy star, which astronomers call a white dwarf. Now, they knew all this before we did because they had this information long before Sir Arthur Eddington even described white dwarfs in the 1920s. And so this is why the book is called The Sirius Mystery, because their entire religion and culture was based upon the star Sirius and all this esoteric knowledge, which happens to be correct astrophysically and numerically. So how on earth did they get it? Where did it come from? And the first place to turn to get an answer to that question is to ask them where they got it from. And what they say is that it was brought from beings who came from the system of the star Sirius. So it's not my idea, it's their idea. They're the people with the information, and that's their explanation for it.
Do you think there's it's just coincidence that it's the Dogon tribe, the dog star, and Anubis?
Well, that's a doggone problem you just raised there. As we would say down in Kentucky where I come from, that sure is one hell of a doggone problem you just put there to me.
Yeah, but it's actually not funny. I'm being serious. It could be true.
Well, the first thing to say about this is that the Dogon tribe, and I think that the name is a pure coincidence, by the way, do not claim to be native to Mali.
Yeah.
In other words, we're not talking about spaceships landing in West Africa. They migrated. Mm-hmm. And then a large part of the book of the Sirius Mystery is devoted to studying the migration routes of the ancestors of these West African tribes in Mali and Ghana.
I hate to do it because we're just getting into some more interesting stuff here. But we're running up against the end of the show, and I want to thank both of you for being with me. And as I close the show, if you will, just stay on the telephone line with me. I'd like to talk with you for just a moment after the show. Folks, I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have. You'll want to click on Robert Temple's picture and go to his website, and on Olivia's picture and go to her website. Check it out. There's a lot of great information there, lots of great photos. If you have any interest in these mysteries at all, that's the place to go. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.